Goddard, reel number two.
I said to him, what are we going to do? And he said, we are going to sink some cement boats in the Kiel Canal. This alarmed me very much indeed. It wasn't the sort of thing I wanted to do at all, but at that point the guard blew his whistle and I got back into the train and, in fact, slept on the seat until we got to Euston. And next morning I went to the Admiralty at about 10 to 10 and found that I was one of the last to arrive of a body of about... well, they looked like sub-lieutenants, most of them. There were only three or four midshipmen there. I can remember three other midshipmen besides myself who I could name, and the rest were sub-lieutenants, and there were a dozen of us altogether. That's fine. To the second floor, to the second Sea Lord's office, and Omni, being the spokesman, knocked at the door and was admitted, and I suppose he reported inside, and presently he came out, and then a moment or two afterwards a very tall naval commander came out and said the second Sea Lord is not in the habit of seeing any officer below the rank of post captain, and then only by appointment, and you may rejoin your ships. Well, as we'd come from Scapa Flow, in the most cases, and two or three of us from Rosyth, this wasn't a very happy prospect, besides which we didn't know how to get a railway warrant to get back, and we thought there was a great mistake. So there was a discussion amongst the sub-lieutenants. I stood in the background, and when nobody had any ideas, I said, I have got a letter from my captain addressed to Admiral Hamilton. And so Omni said, well, for goodness sake, he is the second Sea Lord, take it in. So I took this letter in, and the commander then took the letter from me and took it into the inner office where the second Sea Lord was, and presently I was admitted, and I saw this old boy sitting at his desk, looking at me over the top of his spectacles, holding the letter in one hand, and looking at me with his eyes and saying, well, I see that your captain has sent you on this enterprise, but I don't approve of it. Good morning. So I then began to say, can you tell me what we're going to do, sir? And the commander clapped his hand on my shoulder, wheeled me round and said, don't argue with the second Sea Lord, out. And so I went out and was thrown out into the passage, where, of course, I was regarded as a complete washout by the rest of the party. But at that moment, fortunately, as it turned out, the door at the end of the passage banged suddenly, which startled us. We looked round and saw a figure walking up the corridor with his hand behind his back. He was wearing a naval monkey jacket with brass buttons in front, and his head was bowed. It was grey, so we couldn't see who he was, and he was coming towards us. And as he came towards us, we made way for him, and I, being at the back, saw his arms first, that it was covered with gold braid. He was an admiral of the fleet, and it was, in fact, Jackie Fisher. He had just had his final row with Winston Churchill about the Dardanelles. Anyway, he looked up and said, what are all you young officers pluttering up the gangway for? And Omni replied that the Second Sea Lord, we had been ordered to see the Second Sea Lord, and that the Second Sea Lord didn't want to see us. And Fisher brightened up at that moment and said, ah, he said, you must be my midshipman, come in. And so he led us into his office, said, stand around there. And then we stood around his desk, which was a great big open desk with no papers on it except a nice new sheet of blotting paper. And he then looked at the desk for a bit, and then he looked up at us, and he regained his composure and said to us, if any of you young officers ever have to deal with politicians, don't trust them. And so this was a startling remark, as we knew that the politician he'd just been dealing with was Winston Churchill, who was then quite a young man. Then he said, when I want a job done well, I send for junior officers. They do what they're told. And this also impressed me a little bit negatively. I didn't quite like the attitude, but nevertheless, he went on to say, especially if it requires bravery, and if it requires courage, and they go through with things, they don't hesitate. This also alarmed me quite a lot, because I didn't think I was that sort of person. Well, he then began to talk about Nelson, and having talked about Nelson and how splendid he was as a young man and how his courage carried him through to great heights, later on he then broke off remembering Lady Hamilton and had to make a dissertation about her. This quite shocked me as coming from Jackie Fisher, because he said that none of us Englishmen really realized how much we owed of England's greatness to Lady Hamilton. And anyway, after that subsided a bit, he walked across the room, he walked through us, and we continued to look to our front. I heard him unhitching from the wall a picture, which he carried back in his hands, and I thought he was going to tell us about the Battle of Trafalgar or something, but in fact it was about the battle, but in fact he said, "I'm going to read to you the finest piece of prose in the English language," and it began, "May the great God whom I worship grant to our arms this day," and it was Nelson's last prayer. This was too much for David Don, who was the senior of us four or five midshipmen, and he said, "Can you please tell us, sir, what we're going to do?" And Jackie Fisher then said, "Oh, don't you know, you're going to fly airships." And this was the first that most of us had heard of that sort of idea, and it didn't really create a very good impression, because we didn't really, any of us, I think a great deal of the Silver Queen, as it was called, the Astra Torres airship, which had been seen flying about England just pre-war, and in fact came over the fleet assembly at the Royal Review in July that I'd been attending, in a cruiser. Well, he said, "Well, that's all I want to say to you. You must now go and report to Captain Masterman in the Air Department, and he will give you your instructions." So we bade goodbye and went off, rather an anticlimax.
So now, after some 2 days of mystery, the purpose of the transfer was finally revealed.
Yes.
Do you remember your particular reaction at the time, or any reactions of any of the other midshipmen there?
Well, yes, I do. I remember that most of us were relieved in a way that we weren't going to sink cement boats in the Kiel Canal, because that didn't seem to be a very favourable thing to do. I think that we were ready to do our duty in any way. It was wartime and we were prepared to comply with instructions. But as I had recently put in an application to go into the submarine service, the last thing I was really thinking of was going into the air, because that was just the other end of the story. I hadn't really regarded myself as an airman. So I suppose we were distinguished from the other kinds of people who went flying in the early days, because they were all enthusiastic potential airmen, whereas we were rather enthusiastic naval officers who were thought well of by the captains of our ships, sufficiently well of to be required to volunteer for special temporary service. And so it wasn't to be surprised at that we didn't really feel awfully enthusiastic. It was, for us, another naval job to be done. And it was interesting. We were young, and of course when we found ourselves at Roehampton, where we were quartered, which was a sort of RNVR officers' mess, and the RNVR officers were mostly well-moneyed types, and my pay as a midshipman was then 1 9 pence a day, and the mess bill standard charge at that place was already 11 shillings a day.
Can I just ask you a question?
Yes.
Before we go on to Roehampton, do you think the significance of this means of selecting young naval officers for the Royal Naval Air Service had any significant effects, whether detrimental or the opposite, on the actual development of the service?
Oh, I would say that the men who were chosen at that time, those who stayed flying, and some went back to the Navy, were most of them destined to be senior officers. They had that sort of thing about them which would cause them to have authority later on. And so it was a good thing from the point of view of furnishing the new service that was yet to come a long way off then with men who were potentially going to be senior officers. And I think quite several of them did become pretty senior and very useful. And also we were adaptable. We were all pretty well trained as officers. And I expect that we were. We had our degree of conservatism, which is built into young naval officers, especially when you're taken, as we were, at the age of 12 and a half, and put under naval discipline.
So one of the consequences of this method the Navy chose for staffing the early naval air service, one of the consequences was that it gave personnel of higher than average quality to the new service.
Well, it gave personnel of higher than average quality, I suppose, forgive the lack of modesty about this, to the airship service. But the aeroplane side of the thing was already recruiting enthusiasts from civil life who had no background in naval training and consequently received the usual disapprobation of the regular officers who inherently disliked the amateurs.
Now, after your transfer to the RNAS had taken place, you were posted in the spring of 1915 to Roehampton to begin your training. Could you describe the setup at Roehampton?
Well, Grove House, as I remember it, in Roehampton Lane, was evidently a very rich man's house, which had been taken over by the Admiralty, or, for all I know, given to the Admiralty, or loaned to the Admiralty, complete with a staff of butler and servants to look after the house and the garden. It was in most beautiful order. It was springtime. Everything was most attractive when we got there, luxurious to a degree. And to my astonishment, I found, after I'd been there a few days, that the mess bill was 11 shillings a day in those times, which was quite a lot of money, especially as my pay as a midshipman was then 1 9 pence a day, and I wondered how I was going to make ends meet at all. Well, we only used the place as an officer's mess. It belonged really to the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, the RNVR, or Wavy Navy, as it's become called. They were the administrators of all the auxiliaries attached to the Navy at that time, whereas the pilots of the RNAS were men who wore the executive stripes of the regular naval officer for some reason which is, I think, fairly easily explainable, in that the original pilots in the Naval Air Service were all from the executive branch of the regular Navy. And so when people like Graham White and other distinguished aviators were taken in and given naval uniforms, no distinction was made in their stripes, and the RNAS pilots wore the broad stripe and the curl of the executive branch of the Navy. That was our officer's mess, and all we used it for was for eating, sleeping, and resting. We were taken away from there day by day in a Talbot tender, as I remember, you know, a sort of box tender, when we were wheeled off in some discomfort to another luxurious establishment, which was the Hurlingham Club.
What was the lifestyle like at Grove House, and how did it compare and contrast with what you were used to?
Well, I don't know whether you can imagine what a midshipman's life in the Grand Fleet was like. To begin with, we would begin the day by tumbling out of our hammocks, which were slung close to a deck, maybe not in the usual midshipman's quarters, but in a place near action stations. We lived in great discomfort. Our accommodation for our clothes and that sort of thing was a midshipman's sea chest. And coaling ship and all that sort of thing produced quite a difficult and rather dirty life. To come to Roehampton, which was beautifully appointed and luxurious to a degree, and sleep in comfortable beds and have meals of first-class cuisine offered to you by liveried servants was something quite spoiling. And of course, we as young midshipmen enjoyed this kind of style of life very much indeed. But for the expense, it suited us very well.
Amongst these unaccustomed, luxurious surroundings, did you maintain any of the normal naval traditions that one would expect in the mess?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that the Volunteer Reserve had any particular influence on that. I don't remember that we had any formal dinner. We used to be in or out to dinner as it pleased us, and meals were there to be served when you liked. It was quite informal. There was no routine that I remember at all. More or less like a pleasant hotel.
Now, although you were living at Roehampton, you were doing your balloon flying from Hurlingham. What was the establishment at Hurlingham?
Well, Hurlingham was well established simply as a gentleman's club, where everything was laid on up to the nines, tennis courts, bowling greens, everything you can think of, croquet and indoor sports as well, and a delightful restaurant and clubhouse, spacious lawns and so forth. There was no naval establishment that I could see as such, and of course no balloon hangars or anything like that. The fact was that Hurlingham had been used for that additional outdoor sport of ballooning before the war. Ballooning was quite a thing that quite a number of wealthy and sporting gentlemen used to go in for.